resistance groups pledge to respond with determination to Israeli provocations as settlers prepare for a controversial march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. China accuses NATO of creating confrontation after a vow from the Western military alliance to counter what it calls the challenges posed by Beijing. Also, the headlines: a bomb attack in a military training camp in the Somali capital Mogadishu leaves at least 15 army recruits dead. Well, welcome to our studios near the capital, Tehran. This is Miz. Thanks for joining us. Palestinian factions have warned against any Israeli aggression against their sanctities ahead of a planned march by settlers in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Hamas and the Islamic Jihad movements in the Gaza Strip say that they will respond firmly to any provocative acts by Israeli settlers. Their warning has prompted the Israeli military to raise the level of alert for air defense batteries against possible Palestinian rocket firing. Hamas has also called for protests in the Gaza Strip to counter the planned Israeli march. A similar call has been issued by the Fatah movement in the occupied West Bank. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya has sounded the alarm about dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event dubbed March of the Flags. Rabbi David Feldman says that the planned march by Israeli settlers in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is an outrageous and provocative move that could spiral out yet another round of escalation.
This is truly outrageous. This is a march which is going to take place now, planned to take place, after these marches that did take place early May, just a couple of weeks ago, and we saw, unfortunately, what the outcome was of it. So many people were killed, so much casualties, so much bloodshed, so much misery because of these reckless marches of provocation to make this statement and to fight against the Palestinian neighbors. Unfortunately, when we're talking about a day of rage, this might be a month of rage, this might be a year of rage, this is already going on for decades. This is truly outrageous. And sadly, when this is being done by this settler movement, which they come out in this religious way and they try to present this radicalism, this extremism, this terrible behavior, and they try to show this with a religious face. This is truly embarrassing to Jewish people.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has hailed the end of Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year rule in Israel, referring to him as a tyrant who has fallen. In a tweet, Zarif said Netanyahu's ouster followed several years of war and aggression against the Palestinians and threats to the Islamic Republic. He added the scenario indicates that while the tyrant has fallen, Iran continues the march of glory, and the Gaza Strip is raising the sign of victory. The top Iranian diplomat expressed hope that Netanyahu's successors would learn that the Israeli regime, which was founded on the basis of aggression and occupation, will not last long. On Sunday, the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister. Journalist and political commentator Sid Mohsin Abbas says Benjamin Netanyahu was behind numerous atrocities in the West Asian region, and if it was not for Iran, his Balkanization plots would have succeeded.
So the truth is, a lot of what Israel does is through proxies, and most of, the millions of deaths across the West Asian region, the Arab region, and beyond, could easily, if you wanted to really do a proper money trail or a real search of the links that all these forces have had that created murder, mayhem, torture across West Asia, whether it's Daesh, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's the MKO, whether you want to go to any other group which has created huge, if you like, violence in the region, or, for that matter, the despots and the other tyrants like the Sisis of the world and the Mubaraks of the world over the past, from Egypt to Afghanistan. Israel has had his hand behind it, and Netanyahu, during his 12-year office, has been one of the worst culprits in unleashing these demons across West Asia. And had it not been for the Islamic Republic of Iran and its stoic resistance in Yemen notably, Syria notably, of course Lebanon, and now Palestine most recently, Iraq, not forgetting Iraq, of course, without the backbone of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Israel would have got away with its balkanization, murder, and terrorizing policies.
Yemenis have held a sit-in protest in front of the UN's office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the international community for turning a blind eye on the suffering of the impoverished nation amid the Saudi-led blockade. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemen's medical workers came together in front of the UN office to vent their anger at the continued seizure of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition, which has led to the closure of many medical facilities in the war-torn country.
The health sector has been badly affected by the siege in our country. Health facilities need fuel to be able to run medical equipment such as dialysis devices. The stopping these services means the death of thousands of patients. Today we need more medical equipment, but Saudi-led coalition prevents us from having access to them by its siege.
Yemen's Ministry of Health has announced repeatedly that most health facilities have to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel. Hundreds, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and to pressurize the Saudi-led coalition into releasing the seized oil tankers and opening Sana'a Airport. According to the UN, the Saudi war on Yemen, along with a years-long blockade, has driven the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
People here say tightening the blockade will only put the lives of thousands of patients at risk and hamper the political solution, as the Yemeni army says it will continue advancing to Madab city until it is fully liberated from the Saudi-backed forces.
Shia civilians in Afghanistan have been among the main targets of terrorist attacks over the past years. This has sounded the alarm in the war-torn country, with many, including prominent religious leaders, calling on the central government in Kabul to protect Shia population against terrorist violence. Amin Alami has more.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least 7 Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for western Kabul or approve people's security plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warn of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
China has accused the Western military alliance, NATO, of artificially creating confrontations with Beijing. The Chinese mission to the European Union has urged NATO to stop exaggerating what it called a threat theory against Beijing. The mission says NATO's latest stance proves to be the continuation of a Cold War mentality. On Monday, NATO leaders vowed to work together to counter challenges posed by China. They accused the Asian powerhouse of threatening the international order through assertive actions, among other things. Tensions have mounted between China and the West in recent months over a range of issues, including human rights. The U.S. aircraft carrier group has entered the South China Sea amid heightened tensions with China. The U.S. Navy said that the strike group is called a routine mission is on its way. The Navy said that the warships will be conducting maritime security operations, including flight operations and strike exercises. Washington frequently stages war games and deploys warships in the South China Sea, especially near Chinese islands. Beijing has repeatedly objected to the missions, saying that the U.S. seeks to stoke tensions at China's doorstep. At least 15 army recruits have been killed in the Somali capital Mogadishu. The victims lost their lives in a suicide bomb attack on a military training camp. Somali officials say the bomber was disguised among recruits lining up outside of the camp when the blast occurred. The attack was the deadliest to hit Mogadishu in the past 18 months. No group or person has claimed responsibility yet. Similar attacks in the past have been blamed on the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Its members have been trying to overthrow the Somali government for more than a decade. A prominent rights group says that the UN improperly collected data on more than 800,000 Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh and passed them to Myanmar. Human Rights Watch has said that the move by the UN Refugee Agency is contrary to its own policies and exposes Rohingya to further risk. The group urged the UNHCR to investigate the issue. The UN agency has been registering the Rohingya refugees in Bangladeshi camps since they fled a 2017 deadly crackdown in their homeland, Myanmar. The agency says the data was meant to provide the refugees with identity cards, but Human Rights Watch says the Rohingya were given consent forms that they could not read to share their data with Myanmar. Many of the refugees have refused to return to Myanmar, fearing a repeat of the 2017 crackdown that the UN has called genocide. On to India. India has registered more than 60,400 new COVID cases in the past 24 hours. It's the lowest daily rate that the country has logged since March 31. The new figure brings India's total caseload to over 29.5 million. The South Asian nation also reported over 2,700 new fatalities in the past 24 hours. Its overall deaths now stand above 377,000. COVID-19 surged in India in April and in May. That caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator has slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19.
What the G7, I think, should have done was develop a genuine global plan to vaccinate the world. It would cost, the IMF has worked out the cost of this, it would cost around $50 billion. It could be paid over a period of years. That, by the way, is the deal of the century, because until the pandemic ends, everybody is going to face huge risks and potential problems. So these sporadic, small-scale, charitable handouts from rich countries to poor countries is not a serious plan. It will not bring the pandemic to an end.
Mark Lowcock stressed that the G7 completely failed to show the necessary urgency with regard to the pandemic, adding that they still have a lot to do. He said that these developed nations should have done more to provide vital supplies, like oxygen ventilators and testing kits, to the countries that are going to wait longer for vaccines. Separately, the World Health Organization chief said that the G7 nations need to do more to deal with the global COVID crisis.
I welcome the support expressed by the G7 for WHO, the ACT Accelerator, and the idea of a treaty on pandemic preparedness and response. And I welcome the announcement that G7 countries will donate 870 million vaccine doses, primarily through COVAX. This is a big help, but we need more. And we need them faster. More than 10,000 people are dying every day. During this press conference alone, more than 420 people will die.
Tedros said that Africa is the most vulnerable that needs vaccines the most. The WHO wants at least 70% of the world's population vaccinated by next year's G7 meeting in Germany. Wealthy nations' reluctance to suspend intellectual property protections has hampered the production of much-needed COVID vaccines. The UK government is set to keep most coronavirus lockdown rules in place in England for another 4 weeks, beyond its planned June 21 unlocking. As Said Pourza reports, the news has led to public disappointment and criticism of the government's handling of the so-called Delta variant, believed to be driving up the infections.
England's big day pushed back again. Another disappointment for those who have made plans, such as wedding ceremonies and vacations, past what's been dubbed Freedom Day.
You've got to be cautious in order to deliver what we want to see, which is an irreversible roadmap, but we're looking at the data today.
And the data is concerning. While hospitalizations and deaths remain relatively low, they're rising. The culprit, the Delta variant, first discovered in India, spreading rapidly. the government is facing criticism for dragging its feet in putting India on the red list.
It was clear that that was probably more infectious, affecting people who are slightly younger and slightly more severe in its spectrum of disease, we think. And so, yeah, it would have made perfect sense to put restrictions on India. Of course, post-Brexit, Boris was at that time planning a visit to India. I didn't want to set the wrong mood music, and he cancelled that at the very last minute.
The Delta variant is considered about 40% more transmissible than the UK's Kent variant and is blamed for more than 90% of all new infections in the country. Most infections are among the unvaccinated. And while the vaccines are working against the Delta variant, two doses are said to be more effective than one. And with only just over half of adults having received both jabs, the number of people in hospital with COVID is bound to grow further. The country's health system may be facing a difficult summer.
It's really curious to me that the government is experiencing a so-called vaccination bounce, that people are so happy they're coming out of this period, that actually the Conservatives are doing relatively well in elections, because really their management of this pandemic has been characterized by mismanagement, ignorance, and kind of willful malice almost from the first. Not only have they had a beleaguered NHS, which they knew wasn't able to cope with the pandemic, which they've done nothing to address, but in fact have used the opportunity of the pandemic to fast forward their privatization measures.
While the UK continues to inoculate its entire population, much of the rest of the world remains unvaccinated, meaning the threat of new variants developing is still out there. As for the UK government's so-called roadmap out of lockdown, well, that may have just been proven not so irreversible after all. Cypher is up, London.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leaders' speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31st, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
Another task that should be carried out is that this assembly should enjoy equanimity and dignity. That is to say, the people who participate in this assembly and who are elected should enjoy the necessary dignity and position in scholarly, political, social, and religious areas so that they can satisfy the people on the day they are supposed to make a choice. Therefore, the dignity and equanimity of this assembly is another important issue. Those who have the necessary qualifications should step forward. That is to say, anyone who feels that they have the capability to do this and anyone who has the necessary qualifications for being a member of this assembly and for satisfying God should step forward and enter the arena. In my opinion, it is a religious obligation for anyone who can carry out this responsibility. Only God knows when they should carry it out in a free and independent way and by observing religious obligations to step forward and enter the arena. I have said this many times about other elections as well. Those who think they have the capability to run for presidential, parliamentary, and other elections should enter the arena. However, the Assembly of Experts elections are more urgent than other elections. Those individuals who really feel they have the necessary competence and capability should enter the arena, make themselves available to the people, and participate in this important and honorable assembly. All the people too should consider it their responsibility to participate. By Allah's favor, at the right time, we will discuss certain points with the people about the Assembly of Experts. We have certain recommendations which by Allah's favor, we will offer to the people. It is not late yet. I should briefly say in this meeting that participation in elections is a public duty.
Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in 2 explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success. Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's while the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. As I said, though, Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's while Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic, a slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
Human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end. Ahead of its visit to the United Kingdom to attend the G7 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled America's plan to help poorer nations fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
Other G7 nations have also pledged to chip in to meet the group's 1 billion dose target. In the meantime, health and anti-poverty campaigners say while the G7's pledge is a step in the right direction, it falls short of the number of doses needed to win the battle against the pandemic. Charity organization Oxfam said, to end the COVID crisis, the world needs 11 billion doses of vaccines. It also called on the G7 to support a push for a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move that would give other nations better access to the much-needed jabs.
I think that the amount of doses being offered are absolutely a drop in the bucket, and we've seen certainly here in the United States that the country was very, very cautious about releasing doses, hoarding doses, really, of the vaccine for a very long time. Partly with a notion of protecting the local residents first before sharing vaccines with the rest of the world. And I do think this is a very short-sighted approach because the vaccine does not know boundaries. The vaccine does not know national borders. And so as we've seen with the way the pandemic spread, you have to vaccinate the entire world in order to protect everyone in the world. So the idea of reserving doses just for your own population, I think, is very, very short-sighted on the part of all of these countries.
According to Johns Hopkins University, over 2.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide as of June 12, 2020. At this rate, several countries are expected to fall short of the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their population against the infectious disease by September.
Relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia ordered the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. Ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight, as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
Yeah, what the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
At first, it was dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but now the idea is gaining traction and international attention. The coronavirus, or COVID-19, as it became known, may have originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. This was a claim that former U.S. President Donald Trump had stated, in which he received a lack of flak for calling it a Chinese virus. But what has led to a rise in this theory? The fact that the virus leaked out of a laboratory in Wuhan was never really dismissed outright in the first place. Now, a report on the origins of COVID-19 by a U.S. government national laboratory concluded that the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese lab in Wuhan is plausible and deserves further investigation.
My take is that the American government is changing its attitude from time to time and aimed more at being anti-Donald Trump and anti-China than anything else. It does not recognize that it really was a biowarfare weapon, as I and others firmly believe.
This was apparent when, as recent as last week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the intelligence needs to be gathered as to the origins of the virus. U.S. intelligence agencies are considering two likely scenarios: that the virus resulted from a laboratory accident, or that it emerged from a human contact with an infected animal. Meanwhile, U.S. government sources said a classified American intelligence report circulated during the Trump administration, which alleged that the three researchers at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology became so ill in November 2019 that they sought hospital care. U.S. officials have accused China of not being transparent about virus's origin, a charge Beijing denies.
The U.S. moves to shift the blame of COVID-19 is no different from its lies on Iraq's position of weapons of mass destruction. The international community should be vigilant about this. I'm sure such moves will be rejected by people with insight. We urge the U.S. to stop politicizing the study of origins, stop smearing China, adopt an open and transparent attitude on this issue, shoulder its due responsibilities, and invite WHO experts for origin studies in the U.S.
Numerous questions arises out of all of this, and the one that clearly needs to be answered is, why is the U.S. president highlighting the results of the intelligence findings at this point in time? Was he not aware of the intelligence reports like during the time Trump was in power?
My take again is that Biden was and the Democratic Party were doing this as a result of their opposition to Trump and to make him look bad. He's now involved in investigating this because it makes China look bad, and China is now the new enemy.
Furthermore, the WHO at one point clearly rejected the hypothesis that the virus was a result of a laboratory break or to have originated from a lab in Wuhan. It even had a team in Wuhan to investigate this, and the head of the World Health Organization mission said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that the virus spread from a lab leak in the city of Wuhan. Now, after over a year of the outbreak, several Western powers and prominent scientists have publicly stated as woefully inadequate the findings of the WHO. They have stated that those findings were relied on data collected by Chinese officials. This has led to many to conclude that the U.S. is taking political advantage of this in order to gain points against China.
Well, yes, indeed. The U.S. is doing this to obtain political advantage over China, to paint them as an enemy, has ignored its own involvement in the matter in the past, and is ignoring its own flip-flopping over the last year and a half or so.
The U.S. and China are competing in several arenas on the world stage, from sensitive issues like Taiwan and the South China Sea to intelligence like 5G. The U.S. has labeled China as its biggest national security threat. Whether it would at this length to falsely level an accusation of this magnitude remains to be seen.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about a very important topic, and that is the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. In this particular topic, under this particular topic, we're going to talk about some important tenets. We're going to talk about some of the important tenets that are needed to be present in the people and also in the leaders of the society, and how and we're going to discuss about how Muslims need to live, or how Islamic system or an Islamic community need to live as a people to be able to progress and live a life which is covered in divine blessings and goodness. And we are going to base some of our discussions on the sermon of Qasi'ah, which is basically the sermon that is degrading the issue of pride, the moral depravity of pride. it's showing how bad it is, how low it is. And basically, this is probably one of the reasons why it is called Qasa, as was discussed in the previous sessions. In just the previous session before this, we discussed about the fact that in the society there are certain divine norms that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has established, that are repetitive, that are constant throughout time and space, that dominate human society.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, these, we can say these divine norms that dominate human society, that are divine, that are from God, they are always present at every time, at every place. And they are, because of the fact that these divine norms are constants, just like the laws of motion, like just like the laws that are existing in nature. And therefore, for example, according to the laws of motion, if I push something, then it goes. It moves, right? In the same way, if I push it after 5 minutes, it will happen. It will still move. And after 10 minutes, it will move, right? This law is constant, right? Wherever there is matter, wherever there is mass, there is gravity. Maybe if it is the amount of mass is very little, the matter is very little, then of course the gravity will be less. But wherever there is matter, there is gravity. This is a law which is constant, and therefore in the societies also these constants exist, these divine norms exist. These are called sunnatun ilahiyya, norms that are divine regarding the societies. So what is we see that in history, for instance, one of the divine norms is that people who are oppressors, they are never successful. They never progress. And this is something that we've seen. It's a divine norm. When people were oppressive, that society that was oppressive was never successful. So Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us that we contemplate on these previous generations, because you will see the application of those divine norms in those societies, and therefore be careful of avoiding those things that led to their destruction, and to perform those things that led to their progress.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, one of the things that led to the progress and success, and you can say the loftiness of societies, was unity and avoiding disunity. To hold on to be united and to stay away from disunity. That's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, فَإِذَا تَفَكَّرْتُمْ, when you think, when you ponder, from in the different states of these societies. You saw sometimes they were very honorable, but sometimes they were degraded. This will lead you to get inspired about what you are supposed to do. Now, when you ponder upon the history of peoples and what led to their progress, what led to their destruction, this will give you an idea about what you should do today. It will inspire you. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, فَأَلْزِمُوا كُلَّ أَمْرٍ لَزِمَتِ الْعِزَّةُ بِهِ شَأْنَهُ. Get hold on to all of those things that led them to be honorable. وَزَاحَتِ الْأَعْدَاءُ لَهُ عَنْهُ. And get hold of to onto all those things that led their enemies to be destroyed and be defeated. Apply those. Keep them in yourself. Strengthen yourselves with those tenets. Look at them in the history. See what led them to become destroyed. What led them to grow? What led them to progress? For example, look at the community of Moses, Nabi Musa alayhi salam. At one time they were powerful, okay? But at another time they became weak and destroyed and humiliated. There was a reason. Why were they powerful at one time? And why did they become destroyed at another time? Why were they humiliated at another time? At the time of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, they were honorable. They had izzah, they had honor, they had strength. They had, you can say, that special position and loftiness. And so we need to find out what was the reason why they were lofty. What was the reason why they had honor at that time? And then apply the thing in your own lives. And then look at them at a certain point in time, you see that they were degraded by other societies. The communities were controlling them, forcing them to do their will. What happened that they became like that? When you are having this particular mindset and outlook, then you will be able to live a good life as a society. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us that depth in looking into history and taking lessons from them, as has been taught to us by Imam Ali alayhi salam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a speech by Ayatollah Meshkini.
در روایت امام صادق فرمود از دنیا کلها جهل الا مواضع العلم.
In a tradition, Imam Sadiq says, the whole world is ignorance except for the parts where there is proximity to God and knowledge. In Imam's opinion, even the knowledge you gain or your scientific specialty is part of the ignorance in this world if it is not going to result in your proximity to God. And then Imam continues by saying that, any new thing you learn, if it is not going to approximate you to God, then definitely it has created a distance between you and your God.
فرماید جز اونجا که علم در اونجا نفوذ داره، علم اینجا در این روایت علم اون علمی که تو را به خدا نزدیک کند، علم شما.
So in this tradition, by science or knowledge, Imam means anything that can approximate you to God. Anything except this is considered as ignorance. Sheikh al-Baha'i, one of the greatest Shiite scholars, also says, seek knowledge which becomes light in your heart. This is the knowledge we should seek. And then Imam says, the knowledge you gain is definitely a proof against you unless you practice what you learn. So what you learn could stand against you if you do not practice it. Well, Imam continues his words, it is not even enough to practice. What you practice must be with pure intention. The pure intention in what you practice is very important. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Meshkini. Please visit our website, which is parsetoday.com, and by clicking on the tab Call of Islam on the top right corner of the